My name is Zephyr Thrull. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're listening at 89.5 FM KPOO here in San Francisco. You're also listening to Art Radio WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate at www.wps1.org. You might also be listening on the San Francisco Arts Commission website at www.sfacgallery.org, I believe it is, and, of course, frankprattle.com. Today, my extra double triple special guests are Mark Johnson, a professor of art and the gallery director of San Francisco State University. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
And Paul Mullins, an artist and associate professor at the San Francisco State University as well. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
So just to fill everyone in, Frank Prattle is a group of community discussions where we bring two different people on, and they discuss everything from this, that, and the other to objects about art and different ideas about love, life, and everything in between. And the topic we're going to be discussing today is public versus private and all the different ramifications and specifications and different directions that conversation can go. So maybe first you guys can just start with a brief introduction of who you are and what it is that you do.
Starting with me, so I'm a 55-year-old professor. I've been a teacher for the last 25-plus years, and I used to teach painting and make paintings, and then my life kind of took a turn, and it kind of took a turn, I think, starting in the 1980s when I was working at Humboldt State University in Arcata, California, and I started to focus more on the curriculum and what was being taught than teaching two-point perspective one more time. And now I'm a little bit different breed of cat.
Sounds good. Paul, yourself?
I'm Paul Mullins, and I teach at the same institution, San Francisco State University, in painting and drawing. And still make paintings and drawings. Still teach one-point perspective, happily. Not as much fun as the figure, though.
Sounds good. And, Mark, maybe you could share with the listening audience the website for the gallery at San Francisco State.
I think it's gallery.sfsu.edu. We're happy. We're just setting up an exhibition right now, which maybe I can talk about art and criminal justice in America. So the wonderful thing about the gallery at the university is we get to alternate exhibitions of student work, which is exciting, with exhibitions that are thematically organized. And one thing I like to think about myself is, you know, elegance and beauty. And earlier I was eavesdropping as you were talking about the third party of our conversation, meaning that there are two guests, so we're one part and you're the second part, but the third part is the listening audience.
And the mystery party.
Yeah, and so all the people out there, they're interested in art too, or they wouldn't be listening to this. And how come you got interested in art? Because it's sort of a odd thing. Most people wouldn't say that, I think, in the world today that they're passionately interested in art. But for those of us that are, you know, what was it that, you know, caused you to be interested? And I think for me, it was this sort of intersection of elegance and beauty and, I don't know, bravery, kind of thinking, I don't know, brave thoughts. So anyway, this criminal justice show, which is elegance of kind of brave thoughts in a provocative way.
Sounds good.
Excellent battery of artists in that, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
What,
incidentally.
And just for the listening audience, Paul, if you could give your website, maybe one of your gallery's websites, so they can check out your work while they're listening?
Well, work can be seen at heathermarksgallery.com, but I believe it's February 10th that the name of the gallery officially becomes Marks and Zavatero. So,
just strictly for spelling purposes, that's why they changed it?
Yeah. Well, I think you can put in, I hope this isn't wrong, but I believe you can put in Marks Zav, and it'll take you to the same place.
Sounds good.
For people like me who might misspell it. And you can also see work at Nathan Laramendi Gallery and Gescheidel in Chicago.
Perfect. Well, maybe we can continue from where Mark started. And, Paul, if you'd just tell us why art? I mean, there's a million things to do in the world. certainly isn't for the money. Money's horrible in the art business unless you happen to be Damien Hirst or something along those lines, which I don't think any of us are. Sorry, no offense. But why art?
You know, that's a good one, and I get it over and over and over, and I expect to be asked that question. And I feel like that's my answer periodically based upon looking back from where I stand at that time. I felt in high school, I thought that I was certainly thinking a lot more about what I didn't want to do than what I wanted to do. And I did art. It may have been the only thing I thought I was good at. But when I looked around the available options, you know, most of them really repelled me. So while it often seemed against my better judgment even, I thought, well, this is the one thing that I should give a shot to. You know? So it wasn't lofty. It was at the time I remember feeling in the, you know, being in school and making decisions based upon wanting to do art, and eventually every decision I would make was about that. Don't do this, do that instead. Because if you ever want to do this, you're going to have to put everything you got into it. And I remember there often having a feeling of desperation about that. Not in art making, that was pure joy, but in the idea that I'd somehow fashion a life around it that let me do what I wanted to do. But, you know, that can be a heck of a motivator, too.
Yeah.
You know, the absence of something or feeling like you... You know, it wasn't easily obtained. That becomes attractive to people.
And for yourself, Mark, would you say similar things along those lines?
Yeah, I think the not lofty part is the part that I responded to the most, because for me, you were talking about the relationship of art to money making, and I think for me, the reason that I am interested in art is because it is the opposite of money making. I'm not a transcendentalist, but I am thrilled to sort of use my entire human being to participate in life in a direction that isn't about, you know, getting ahead financially. Mm-hmm. It's some other whole, you know, exciting way of dealing with the world, I think. And that's why I'm so blessed to be, I think, a teacher. I'll just tell a quick story. We were talking about sort of brave voices a few minutes ago, and one of my favorite brave voices is the cultural critic, Bell Hooks. And Bell Hooks was joking with me and said, well, you know, I think I'm kind of jealous of you, because there's four keys to happiness. And, you know, one of them is that you live in a place that you like, and it doesn't have to be Acapulco with a view, but you like it well enough. And the second is that you have enough money. You don't have to be Bill Gates, the richest man in the world, but you got enough money so that you can get by. And the third one, she said, is that you have a job that brings you some fulfillment. You don't have to discover a cure for cancer. And, of course, the fourth one was that you find someone to spend your life with. It doesn't have to be Romeo and Juliet, the greatest love affair ever told. But if you have those four things, you have the four keys to happiness. But Bell Hooks said, but the punchline is nobody gets all four. And, of course, maybe that is the case or maybe it isn't. And I do feel pretty lucky, because I think I have different doses. But I've definitely got, I think, that third key, which is a fulfilling way to engage with the world, and that's because I'm happy to be involved with the arts. I laugh every day.
That third key is essentially what I think what I was speaking about. And it's funny, because right after I came to teach at the State, Bell Hooks spoke, and it was a very sort of significant thing for me, 2 weeks on campus, having come to San Francisco. Bell Hooks is talking over here, and I was sort of like, wow, you know, as you hear him bring up that story. Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds good. As far as kind of talking about your private life, Paul, and growing up in rural West Virginia, that tends to inform your work pretty heavily, does it not?
Pretty heavily, at least.
Yeah. Some would say
I've tried to make it less, and it comes back unbidden. So, absolutely, absolutely. And I feel like anybody who spends the first 21 years of their life somewhere is one way or another, that's going to show up somewhere if you're being 10% honest or you know, something. And I found I get the best, I get the things that I can live with coming out of my studio when I don't combat that at all and I just let it go. And particularly the things that have to do with then leaving behind a certain type of environment and going to those that are quite dramatically different and trying to make sense out of that, which I think is, I represent most artists come from somewhere else and then position them somewhere so they can do what they want to do. And then that itself is a big chunk,
right,
you know, of what's going on.
And for those of you listening, we happen to be in the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery right now, and Paul Mullins, you have some work hanging here, and just to briefly describe it for them, you have a large oil painting of a motor, an engine block motor, that is from an all-terrain vehicle, I believe, four-wheeler, three-wheeler?
Or a go-kart.
Go-kart, even. Could be go-kart. You have some pencil drawings of trucks and dogs, and one dog, I believe, humping a football helmet, one of my personal favorite. And then you have some pictures of trailers, I believe they are,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. From West Virginia.
Well, that was actually in Tennessee.
Tennessee,
but
okay.
Same region, yeah. Mountains.
Yeah, with some text over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, these are all the kind of images one associates with, you know, not only rural America, but more specifically to a southern kind of, I would say, taste of America that way.
Mm-hmm.
And do you tend to focus on those things specifically? And also, we'll get to the word white trash and what that means soon, too.
I do. I think if you spend a little time, you find out that you know, there's something underneath there. I've lately been trying to make these things as straightforward as I can, meaning the ATV engine is something fit for a painting. You know, my father used to say to me things like, "Why don't you paint something somebody would want, like a 12-point buck or something? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this weird stuff?" You know, and of course at the time, you know, I wasn't going to have anything to do with, not at all interested in what I could have done there that might have even, I might have been able to support myself if I had just, you know, listened to that sort of recommendation. And here I am years later in San Francisco, and I'm doing wildlife art, which is probably one of the few things you could do in my place of origin and support yourself. And I'm trying to figure out if it's possible to do those kind of things and have them work in both contexts. I don't know. It may be just a matter of what you take and where you put it, but I feel like both cultures would respond favorably to what I'm doing. And I do mean these subjects to be revered. You know, you're putting them into this work because you're saying this is important, you know. I want to talk about this. And that is often treated with a different perspective, a more ironic or a more sort of, you know, when you see that in urban areas or you see that in important galleries or places.
Such as this one?
Pardon?
Such as this gallery.
Oh, yeah.
Very important.
It's an extremely important space.
I had a question. And again, both Paul and I teach at San Francisco State University, so that community of artists is one that we're all familiar with, and one of that community is a professor who retired a few years ago named Robert Bechtel, and he's known as a photorealist who depicted automobiles in his work. So for those listeners, you might recognize that kind of iconography. Had a big solo show at the Museum of Modern Art. And I was very interested in the critical response, because now showing images that he's been making over the past 40 years, Paul just used the word irony. And I always sort of saw this sort of ironic edge to his pictures of automobiles and the Gran Torino and stuff like that. But I thought one of the most interesting reviews that I read of the work, of course, you know, we now know that it happens to be, you know, his mom's car, or, you know, something he knew real well. You know, this was family's cars that he was painting. But one of the reviews that I read said, it isn't really irony that is informing these. It's the artist's own discomfort with this reality that he or we find ourselves in. So just for Paul, I was wondering, is this a homey environment? So it's got that, or is it the sort of discomfortable environment?
It's both. If I'm getting anywhere, it's both. Take the perspective often of everything is sort of correct and fits, and there isn't any of this sort of mixed emotions, but there is, which always sort of comes through. And it's both. I could never say that any of these things, or any of the work I did before this, there was fighters and macho type men, which is, again, it was always flavored the inhabitants of these places. And I always said that there was a little bit of calling things into question, but also, you know, great love, great understanding, great sympathy. It's both.
Sounds good. So you two, in addition to working at San Francisco State, have actually collaborated together on a show for the public called Two and a Half, if I'm not mistaken, a while ago. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I was really fortunate. One day, Mark approached me, and I believe as these things happened, space had sort of opened up in the calendar, and or a need to put something together in limited time and without a huge budget. It's okay that I say that, right? And we decided we would go to work with a California, if not Bay Area only, assembly of something reflecting what was going on among the now. And it actually changed quite a bit from when we first started thinking about what we were going to do to what gelled, but it happened very, very naturally. Originally, we were considering looking at a figurative show, I believe, or I recall. And there was this thing. I dubbed it Stuff as Paint at some point along the line. It's the best effort I had. But it stuck. It worked. It was appropriate. And plenty of it. And I think it came together very tight.
Not bad. Mark, what are your thoughts on it?
So one of the things we're talking about today is this public-private right. interface. So the university's Fine Arts Gallery is this place that, as we discussed, presents student shows, but it also presents the work of professional artists. So in dialogue with Paul, we said, what kind of an exhibition would help make some energy, and also recognize things that weren't necessarily getting recognized. And this idea of doing a show about artists whose work came off the wall, stuff is pain, mm-hmm. as Paul said, seemed like something that we hadn't ever seen showcased in this kind of an exhibition. So 2.5 is art at the corner of 2 and 3 dimensions. Right. So it was an exhibition that I was very happy about because I think it named something that was happening in a scene and brought people together that maybe had some like-minded thoughts that were not very trendy artists, but very serious, strong, abstract artists.
It really reflected a strong wave or strain of artists who were essentially thinking painterly, but also concerned with the space, with the site-specific also, and incorporating that and busting out of the boundaries of just rectangle or square, placed on the wall, and working with the space also. And it's funny because, here in the bathroom, right behind you, is a piece by Tony Treadway, who was in this show, 2.5.
The piece you're speaking about is a large kind of, I would say, a molding,
mm-hmm.
like a crown molding,
mm-hmm.
that is taking over the entire wall.
Yeah, and taking over is the best way of saying it. These were paintings that took over the spaces that were in.
Sounds good.
Where were you when we were writing about this? We used that.
It was all over the place. Long, long ago. So for people listening, though, is there a way to access this online?
Yep. So gallery website, you can find the documentation still of that. There was no real catalog because we did it on a shoestring.
But we did have an announcement that was as nice as any catalog, in my opinion. It had a sort of physically paid lip service to the gist of the show, and then it folded and had some die-cut parts, and I thought that it was excellent.
Sounds good. And so, Mark, maybe you can kind of extend this conversation a little bit in the direction of what it's like to run the San Francisco State University Gallery. We've spoken a little bit before about how it really rides that line between not only a public, space, but also a private space. I mean, because you are essentially curating it as well as directing it most of the time, no?
Yeah, and I would say the answer to that is it's true that I think I hold the steering wheel, but there are definitely lots of other hands on that
many
wheel.
Many backseat drivers.
Yeah. And again, another reason we talked before about those four keys to happiness, and so one of those keys was this opportunity to work in the arts. Another one is to work in San Francisco and to actually have an opportunity to be a little piece of whatever the arts are in San Francisco that, again, is sort of an under-recognized... Mm-hmm. I mean, because, San Francisco State, not downtown. One time a prominent member of the Bay Area art community said to me, San Francisco State, I'd rather go to San Jose than try to get across town. Because, of course, we're...
What's their name? I'll find them for you.
This is a myth. We're quick and easy. It's a perception. It's not true.
But not too quick and not too easy.
No.
It's a little bit of pride in there, yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm interested in is sort of what creates energy. And I think that university does create a lot of energy. And... the gallery sometimes is a part of that energy. For me, I'm going to just talk about, you said, what's it like to
involved? What's it like to kind of negotiate that? I mean, how much pressure do you feel from other people to put on your walls?
Yeah, we do 4 shows a year again. 2 are student shows, 2 are exhibitions of the work of professional artists. We try to involve our full faculty. Right as we speak, we're just closing an exhibition today. That's been on the road for 3 years, a show Judith Bettelheim organized called Afro-Cuba Works on Paper, 1968 to 2003, that's been touring around. We have another show that's just leaving the Shanghai Museum that we got going a few years ago, and it's been all over the world. And again, that was organized with the help of Whitney Chadwick. So faculty help in many different ways. But it's true that I'm usually the person who can say, I think I know what's going to make it. Because we've got to fundraise for everything, because, of course, the only funding that we get at the university is a very modest amount of student fees, and that is largely intended to support the exhibitions of student work. So that means all of our other funding comes from private fundraising. So that's the private side of the whole thing, and this exhibition about art of dealing with criminal justice, for instance, got support from four different foundations. So anyway, a lot of my job is trying to figure out what can fly, where we can find the money to make it fly, and then seeing if it will fly.
Sounds good. And as far as the show that you have coming up, maybe you could list some of the artists that you have.
Yeah, so again, opening on February 16th. We're installing right now. There's an artist from Los Angeles named Clarence Lin, who has created this major construction, which is the intersection of prison cells and low-income housing, because that's kind of what's getting conflated in our society. We're installing 300 plates by an artist named Julie Green, and these plates are hand-painted blue glaze on white ceramic, but the depiction is the last meal of the last 300 people that have been executed in the United States. There's video work by Jonathan Borofsky, formerly of Los Angeles, now living in Maine. We've got, I think, 19 pieces of baloney that are going to be going up on the wall in another week by an artist named William Pope L., also a Mainite. We're in the process of negotiating a couple of major public works, one by an artist named Rigo, Rigo 23 at this point, and the other is a sort of a grandfather of the art about criminal justice, and his name is Richard Kamler. And Richard Kamler is reprising a piece that he made when Robert Alton Harris was executed 20 years ago. And we started out talking about brave voices, so Richard Kamler went to the zoo, recorded the roar of lions. And then at midnight, the night that Robert Alton Harris was to be executed, the first execution in California in many years, he got a boat and a couple of giant Voice of the Theater speakers. And he navigated that boat so that it was positioned immediately in front of San Quentin, and right at midnight turned on the generator and blared with these giant speakers the roar of the lions, because this was an abomination of nature. We're trying to do that as a public artwork on our campus, so we're seeing if that'll fly right now.
How much I'm wondering, when you're kind of crossing that line or towing that line between what you'd like to do and what, you know, kind of more the administrative line might be along those, how often do you kind of dip into more the guerrilla territory at the gallery? And Paul, in your own work as well, how often do you kind of go against the grain, or maybe what the rules are, and do stuff that is maybe not sanctioned so much by the state or the institution or the gallery even? You know what I mean?
Oh, I feel that I seldom do that in the guerrilla sense. I mean, for me to say that I did probably be an insult to lots of other people. But I might break the rules as far as attitudes towards the media that I work in, painting. And there's lots of those. And there always have been. And maybe fewer now than there was for a long time. But what am I talking about? I'm doing the thing that might completely embarrass me instead of knowing better.
And then just to, I'll answer the sort of on the administrative side of things. There's an old saying that it's a lot easier to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission. So sometimes we do the best we can, and then we have to ask for forgiveness after the fact. And I think only once so far did they actually make me take something down? But
care to share?
Probably best to let it remain obscure.
I believe the first time I put some work on a wall, so I was told to do that in a small town in southeast Ohio when I was about 20.
Somebody told you to take it down?
Yeah.
It what was it
disturbing out? People in the building or something like that. Terrible paintings, mind you. I was just starting out, but
they were offended.
I quickly got some experience in that sort of thing rapidly. Yeah.
Well, so one question that we were talking about a little bit earlier as well, Mark, and I believe Paul, you were talking as well, is the idea of kind of an iconic hero as a painter figure or heroine, if you will, as well. And what makes a superstar painter in a culture? Is it just this kind of inborn talent that arises out of nowhere, a very private thing, a shooting star that eclipses the entire sky and everybody realizes it for pure brilliance? Or does it tend to be more something else, something that is kind of nurtured in a stew, if you will, of other creative elements and then kind of happens to be the one to stumble out of that?
Well, it's certainly something else. I would, all of the former there that you mentioned, I would pipe right up and say, no. There are many, many talented and hardworking people there, but the idea of divine intervention, unavoidable genius, there's a lot more to it than that. Things have to get seen. Iconic painter, we've got Pollock, we've got mythology. We have a long sort of connection between painting and macho, for lack of another word. And all through the masters and up to the 20th century, to people like Bill de Kooning, the Matador and the Bull, these sorts of things. And what do you think about that, Mark?
Yeah, well, what I'm interested in is measures of success that are not the marketplace. And because when people hit the marketplace, to me it's moving out of art, then it's moving into the marketplace. So San Francisco's marketplace is not necessarily its strongest suit. I think what's its strongest suit generally during my 30 years here have been this exciting underground, an alternative space for supporting artists. Some of our, I think, greatest talents were who are now our heroes and heroines, were not necessarily big money makers in their day, even, But anyway, I like to think, what makes excitement? What breeds art, in the community? And one thing that we have been talking about is this sense of what I'm going to call a school. And if you think of Venice back in the day, there were some very beautiful things, very elegant things that were, what made that the case? Was it just that there was patronage there, or was it that there was some sort of spark that happened between people? And I believe it's the spark. And I've seen the spark happen from time to time here. And then the spark seems to, go under a bushel, as it were, and then you sort of keep looking again. But I actually always support whenever there's that flash of spark, whenever I can kind of feel that there's some sort of a school happening. We were joking the other day about, say the Bay Area figurative movement or California figurative painting in general, So I said, Zephyr, of these artists, who might you identify as your favorite, the ones you respond
right.
most strongly to?
My guess would be if I had to pin it down, I would say it was a cross between Nathan Oliveira or Joan Brown were my two faves.
And I don't know, Paul, if you've got any
thoughts about that?
Bay Area figurative.
Yeah, all right.
Bay Area figurative. Do I go with David Park? Do I go with Elmer Bischoff? Do I? That's a hard one to say. That's a hard one to say. You know, Demon Corn actually had early work. If you get before the ones that he's really known for,
yeah,
that was mighty fine.
Those were some good ones, yeah. Mark, you?
Yeah.
I'll mail in my vote.
Okay. And I think many people would point to Demon Corn, I agree. And just for the figurative stuff, you know, I might say Elmer. But the truth is, of course, these are all people who knew each other, who were going to drawing sessions with one another. So in a way, their style is a shared style. It came out of working intimately together. You were mentioning, you know, Willem de Kooning earlier, and certainly he is somebody that came out of a shared moment, a shared style. And so whatever supports that, whether it's literally a school like the kind of school that we work in, whether it's an alternative space that creates, like the luggage store, for instance, has created its own community, I'm really interested to support that, or whether it's things like Frank Prattle that creates an alternative sense of media potential, I'm really interested to support that.
And school, it's the, perhaps now I hear collective or clique more than I hear school. School has almost become, it almost implies the past when you hear it at this point.
I definitely think that, yeah, the word collective has become very large as far as groups of people working together now. I mean, would you say that probably the best art coming out of San Francisco is collective art right now? I mean, you look at the kind of the bellwether of American art, the Whitney Biennial, and San Francisco's representatives this year is one happens to be a Mitzi Peterson, a sculptor, and the other is a Neighborhood Public Radio, a collective. And what, as far as things that you guys see on kind of ground level coming out of San Francisco, is it the collective? Is it that public unit, or is it that private unit that
I don't know how to account for it right away because I'm probably the other model, but I do know that just like Mark, I really appreciate seeing people, like-minded people, pooling resources and making things happen. You know, as guilty as I may be of it at times, this sort of solitary, laconic, misfit locked away in his private laboratory seems to be out of date.
And of course, that's
sorry.
Yeah, that's the model we. Well, I was certainly educated with was the locked away misfit. And you didn't take opportunities to exhibit your work unless they had great solemnity and dignity. And I won't mention some of the artists that I'm thinking about, but
we were talking earlier about heroic painter.
Yeah,
and that was very much the case when these kind of myths were being generated. Almost the idea of this being discovered or something.
And I don't know exactly how people come up with the financial commitment to do it, but so back in the 50s, there was the Six Gallery, and when you see those photos of what the Six Gallery was like, where Allen Ginsberg, Red Howell, and all those, the Joan Brown generation, you know, was getting their start, it was a funky garage, cobwebs, dark wood, no white walls, you know, clamp lights, but now it's this kind of legendary moment. So that was a garage, I understood, maybe. But, you know, some of the exciting spaces now that are not selling a lot of work, but still people are making that investment in culture. It is, again, kind of the opposite of capitalism.
There's a surprising number of those here, also given how expensive, you know, rents and that this is San Francisco. There is a lot of alternative spaces. Many are short-lived, but another springs up.
Sounds good. And unfortunately, I believe that's all the time we have tonight. Thank you both so very much.
What about the white trash thing?
Yeah, you guys, we'll get back to white trash in another date. You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening at 89.5 KPOO here in San Francisco, or you're also listening to Art Radio, WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate at www.wps1.org, or perhaps you're also listening at San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery website at www.sfacgellery.org, and, of course, frankprattle.com. My special guests today are Mark Johnson, the Professor of Art and Gallery Director of San Francisco State University. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.
And Paul Mullins, the Associate Professor at San Francisco State and fabulous artist as well.
Thanks so much to you, Zephyr, and the Arts Commission Gallery.
All right.